Sunshine. How important is sunshine to our health? Can't live without it, can we? All life depends on sunshine. Plant growth, food production. And for us, vitamin D is essential for good health. Sunshine sets the body's circadian rhythms. It enhances mental health. In Oregon, we have some problems. It's called the SAD disease. Have you heard that? Seasonally affective disorder that gets so cloudy that people get sad, literally. A question? I think there's one in here.
Okay, we need to sell it.
Somebody wants one?
Yeah.
See if you can find it, and I'll just let you go ahead and look. So even the mental health is affected by it, and just as I was outside there, walking around in that sunshine and feeling that warm sun on my back, you know, it does something for us, doesn't it, physically and mentally. We also find that sunshine kills germs. Did you know that? So that's one of the antiseptics. When I was up backpacking, I've done a lot of backpacking in my life, and I was talking to a fellow who did research on water, how pure the water was up in the mountains. They don't recommend you drink it now out of the streams anymore, unfortunately. But he says if you were going to drink water up in the mountains, the purest water would be from a lake, an alpine lake. And he says in that top 6 to 12 inches where the sun hits it all the time, he says that's the purest water. That's even purer. That's what's running in a fast creek. I always used to think it was the fast creek. But anyway, sunshine has a lot of positive things for our earth. And we're going to zero in on one that's very important for our health. And sunshine makes vitamin D, doesn't it? But when you live in the northern climates, we don't get much sunshine. And in the wintertime, the sun is low on the horizon. And what rays do come through the atmosphere, all of the rays that make the vitamin D are filtered out. And so you cannot get adequate vitamin D in the winter months in the northern countries. So we need to get vitamin D from somewhere. We either need to get it from the sun. If we don't have the sun, we need to get it in our diet or a supplement. And these are the people who are low or at risk of low vitamin D. And persons living in the northern areas, we mentioned a line from San Francisco to Philadelphia. Those on the north side of that are high risk. People who don't get outside daily for at least 15 minutes of direct sunshine on their skin every day would be at high risk. A lot of people in rest homes, nursing homes, don't get outside, and we find that that's a very high risk for this. Estimates by the National Center for Health Statistics are that about one-third or one out of every three adults in the United States has low or deficient vitamin D. That's pretty high, isn't it? And that's based on an old standard. The new standard is that we should get more vitamin D than that to be in good health. So their estimate's as high as one out of every two people.
So if I fall in that northern plain, so at what point in the year do you get enough?
You ought to start in about September or October and through into springtime till the sun's pretty much overhead. Walking outside in the winter is great for your exercise and all of that, but you probably won't get any vitamin D or very little. Might be good for the mental health, physical health, but we need more direct sun. So we need to get it from somewhere. Here's some studies that have been done. Harvard looked at vitamin D levels in 50,000 health professionals. Those are people who ought to know about all this, right? And what they found was over 10 years, those with low vitamin D were what? Twice as likely to have a heart attack. Isn't that interesting? So vitamin D, we're finding, has been important for a lot of things. I found this out several years ago. Notice that was in 2008. So in 2008, when that study came out, the very next week, I went to the doctor and said, check my vitamin D levels. And what do you suppose they were? They were low. And the cardiologist who did it said, I checked mine this week, and mine were low too. And we're all recognizing. I went to visit with a friend who's a specialist in endocrinology, and he tested his, and his was low. And so in our country, it's very, very common. Here's a study on vitamin D and muscle strength. And we're finding that people who take vitamin D, it improves muscle strength, and particularly in frail or older people, and it helps them to reduce falls. And in this study, reduce falls by 20%. And, of course, in an elderly person, if they fall, that could cause some serious injury or broken hip or arm or something. So that's very important. But anyway, what we're finding is that almost every tissue in the body has vitamin D receptors, from the brain and the muscles and liver and all the way through our body. Here's an early observation of cancer. They noticed that people living in northern areas where the sunshine is less available were at higher risk for colon cancer than those people who got a lot of sunshine, just where they lived. Isn't that interesting? Today, dozens of studies link low vitamin D levels with increased colon cancer risk. Here's, I thought, was a very fascinating one. This is from Lancet, is a medical journal in Europe. Evidence that vitamin D may lower the risk for type 1 diabetes. And this study comes out of Finland. Notice the study. It was a 30-year study. That's a long time, isn't it? It started with children and then saw what happened later on. And during that 30-year study, 10,000 children a study of 10,000 children. And they found that children receiving vitamin D during infancy, they do that there because it's way up north and they need it. They've been recognized it. And if they got vitamin D when they're an infant, they had a 90% lower risk of type 1 diabetes than those children not getting vitamin D during infancy. Boy, that's a pretty significant finding, isn't it? Reduced the risk by 90%. And what causes type 1 diabetes? Nobody knows. But here's a good clue. Taking vitamin D helps. And we find that vitamin D helps with a lot of autoimmune disease. And type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. So that's good to know, isn't it? Finland has the highest percentage of type 1 diabetes. And probably because they're living so far north. And now that their children, or they're recognizing that, and they're giving it to their children, maybe that will drop in future generations. Are there problems linked to low vitamin D? It's osteoporosis. What is that? Well, that's what we see on the other side of here. A healthy bone has more like this, and as osteoporosis and the calcium begins to leave the bone and so on, it becomes more porous. So we get these big openings. The bone is not so strong, and then it's easy to break. This is from Harvard's Nutrition Source website. Just before I came, I wrote down this list. Here's some of the things linked to low vitamin D: osteoporosis, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, multiple sclerosis, infectious disease, even including the flu and the common cold. So what can you see from that? The Lord intended that all of us get some good sunshine regularly. And if we don't, we're in trouble. Here's a study where they combined the data from 18 randomized controlled trials. What we mean by that is where they give a substance, in this case vitamin D, to one group and another group. There was a control group. They got a placebo or something. And then they looked to see if it made any difference in those two groups of people. And those who were getting the vitamin D supplementation found a 7% decreased risk of dying from any cause in those taking the vitamin D. So now they're saying even that it can show that you will live longer, less likely to die if you get vitamin D. So what do you suppose I do now? I took one this morning. Even though I'm still in Florida. I take them year-round now. Take a little more in the winter than I do in the summer. So Nutrition Source recommends at least 1 to 2,000 international units daily. This is Harvard's nutrition site, especially if your exposure is low in the fall and winter. And the new guidelines from the Endocrinology Society of America recommends 1,500 to 2,000 international units a day. And for children, 600 to 1,000. And why do they recommend that? Simply because it is so low, and when you start checking the population, they just say there's no point in even checking it anymore. Everybody just ought to be taking it to make sure. So if you want good health, that's one thing that you can do that looks like it's going to improve the health, and something simple to do, isn't it? When you're eating breakfast, just pop in one of those little vitamin D, D2 or D3. D2 if you're a vegan, D3 if you're not a vegan. Doesn't make any difference in my mind. It's the same thing, but just where it comes from. But some people are concerned. It comes from sheep. Vitamin D3 is lanolin. It comes from the lanolin in the sheep's wool. And that's where I get mine, is because it's cheaper. I'm a cheapskate. D3 is a little more effective. But D2 is good, too. and no problem. Now, it comes from a vegan source. D3 is from an animal source, sheep. And in my mind, it's immaterial because it's just vitamin D anyway. But some people are concerned, so there's how you can do it. Oh, okay. Now, another thing about the sun, we need some, but we don't want too much, right? And all the research says we get too much sun, then what can happen? Yeah, we can have increases of skin cancer, can't we? And here's a 10-year study out of Australia showed that wearing sunscreen regularly decreased the risk of melanomas by 50%. And the most dangerous kind, the invasive melanomas, by 73%. So that's good news, isn't it? We can decrease our risk if we take protection against the sun. So here's 5 ways to protect your skin from too much sun. You can wear sun-protective clothing. And I do a lot of backpacking. When I'm up at the high altitudes, you know, 10,000 feet and above, you get a lot more direct radiation. And some of the clothing is rated to keep the sun from going through the clothing. And that's the kind I buy when I'm backpacking. I also have a hat, not as pretty as that gal's, but it has a big rim. Why the big rim? Well, you want to keep it off of your face and your neck and all of those things, too. So when I'm backpacking up in the high mountains, I wear that big hat. Or seek the shade when the sun for extended times. Wear sunglasses. It's careful to get too much sun. It can also damage the eyes, can it? And that would be cataracts. So there's a few concepts about sun. Sun is good for us. We need some. By the way, how much sunshine do we need to make all the vitamin D we need? Depends on how intense it is. But say between 10 and 4 when it's overhead. And if you have darker skin, you need a little longer time. But what's an estimate for most people? 15, about half of that even. 10 to 15, 10 to 12 minutes. In the first 10 or 15 minutes, your body produces all the vitamin D that it can in your skin if it's exposed to the sun. The skin has cholesterol in the skin. That's one good thing about cholesterol. By the way, if your cholesterol levels are very low, that can be a health hazard for making adequate vitamin D, which can then cause osteoporosis. And I have a close friend where that's the problem.
How much of what percentage of your skin?
If your arms and face were all open to the sun, yeah, 10 or 15 minutes, that ought to do it. If you want to make a little more, take your shirt off or wear short pants or whatever. But in the first 15 minutes, you produce all you can because all the cholesterol that's in your skin that can be converted is already converted. So staying out a half an hour, 45 minutes or an hour, you're not going to get twice as much. You already developed all your skin can. So if you want more than that, then you could go out in the morning and then let that be absorbed and then take some time for the cholesterol to come back again and go out in the afternoon, and then you could get it again. So just a little idea on that. And by the way, how much do you suppose your body produces in that 10 or 15 minutes? 40 or 50,000 international units. That's a lot, isn't it? And you only take about 1,000 to 2,000 a day. So some people are saying, well, don't be quite so concerned. They used to say, don't take over 2,000, it might be toxic. I think they've raised that to 5,000 now. So anyway, we produce a lot. Okay, any questions, comments on vitamin D? If you put the sunscreen, it screens out the rays that make the vitamin D. It's also the same rays that cause the cancer. So that's true. You can't get all the sunscreen on and then go out and expect to get any benefit. Well, that's a good point. Thank you. The main thing, too, is you don't need to be out there too much. If you're out there 10 or 12 minutes, you're not going to get too much, are you? But if you're out there long enough that it starts to turn pink and red, then we've been out there too long. Okay. I think the next one, is it evaluating health information or is it the one on sanitation? Okay, we'll do this one quickly. I think that's the next one. We were in a meeting just a while ago, earlier this morning, and someone was pointing out more people die from people just not washing their hands than other big serious things that we're concerned about. Even more people than perhaps that are killed by guns in the United States. Okay, sanitation is a cornerstone of public health, isn't it? And especially if you're working in poorer countries, it seems to be a bigger problem. So sanitation is very important. access to proper toilets, hand washing, pure water to drink, clean living conditions without pollution, proper food handling. Did you know that in the United States, over 3,000 people die every year from food poisoning that could be prevented by proper food handling? That's as many people that was killed when the planes ran into the Twin Towers in New York. And that happens every year in the United States. You don't see that on the television every night, do you? But having good food cleanliness and food sanitation and so on, handling food properly, could save a lot of lives. When I was working with a group down in Inter-America, three out of five children would die before they reached the age of five in that community in which we were working. And why was that? Poor sanitation. And when we got clean water and taught them how to be cleaner and wash their hands and deal with diarrhea and all of those kinds of things, the death rate dropped significantly. So here's some basic concepts we just talked about here. Access to a proper toilet. We take some of these things for granted in our country, don't you? Don't we? When you're over in some other areas. I traveled across Tibet one time, spent about a month over there, and they didn't know what a toilet looked like. And there were some pretty poor sanitary conditions. And, of course, over there they just use the outdoors and go behind the bush and so on. Never bother to bury it or whatever. So it can be a lot of problems. Notice here, 40% of the world's population lacks access to a proper toilet. Of course, this can lead to spread of bacteria and viruses and parasites and all kinds of diseases, diarrhea and cholera, and parasites and so on. And it's estimated that 15,000 people die how often? Daily, due to poor sanitation on a world basis. 5,000 die each day due to diarrheal disease. So maintaining good sanitation in whatever area we're in, and especially if you're working in a poor developed area, extremely important. And even here in the United States, it's critical. Washing our hands is critical for spread of germs, both in food contamination, for colds and the flu, diarrhea, and other infections. And it wasn't just a few years back in the late 1800s that this doctor cut the risk of maternal deaths by 90% simply by washing his hands between patients. Isn't that amazing? And so they were spreading one from one mother to the next, the infection, as they were there in the hospital. When should you wash your hands? Here's a list. Before, during, and after preparing food. Before eating food. Before and after in caring for someone who's sick. Before and after treating a cut or wound. After using the toilet. After changing diapers. After blowing your nose, coughing, or sneezing. After touching an animal or animal waste. After touching garbage. So washing our hands can do a lot towards spread of germs. And if you wanted to know how you should wash your hands, here's what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say. Wet your hands with clean running water and apply soap. Rub your hands together to make a lather and scrub them well. To be sure, scrub the backs of your hands between your fingers and under your nails. Continue scrubbing and rubbing for at least 20 seconds. Then rinse your hands well under running water and dry your hands using a clean towel or air dry them. So in other words, be thorough. Now, what can you do if you don't have places to wash your hands? When we were going across Tibet, there wasn't running water everywhere. So what can you do? My wife carries this little Purell bottle in her purse, and I've got one in my backpack there. We're getting ready to go to China in a couple of weeks, and we'll be over there for a month. And I'm sure we'll have two or three there, so you can use an antiseptic and rub and apply that to your hands, and that can help decrease the diseases, can it? And then how about water? Pure water saves lives. And one of the things that ADRA does is go to these countries around the world and puts in a water well, gives them pure water, and the sickness and the early deaths in those villages drop dramatically. So pure water is important. Notice that it has the potential to prevent at least 9.1% of the global disease burden and 6.3% of all deaths if people had pure water. How do you purify water? We always just take it for granted. It comes out of the tap. What if you had a hurricane and your water supply was damaged? or some other disaster. It's important to know some of the basics, isn't it? So here's the recommendation by Departments of Health. Boiling is the safest. Bring water to a rolling bowl. Boil for how long? At least a minute. Then let the water cool to drink. Another way is to use household bleach, Clorox. And you add 3 to 5 drops of bleach per quart of water. You mix it thoroughly and let it stand for 30 to 60 minutes, longer if it's cloudy. And that should also purify the water, which works fairly well. And there's also commercial water tablets or iodine tablets. Have you ever used those? When we go backpacking in the mountains and there's contamination and even in those mountain streams now, and they recommend that you do that. So we treat the water, put in one of those iodine tablets, put the lid on, shake it good, let it set for the 15 to 30 minutes, and then we can drink that water and it's safe. So those are some ideas, and we should be prepared for those things should there be a disaster. Next one is preventing food-related illnesses. Notice here, each year, foodborne diseases account for 1 in 6 Americans, it says, will get sick from contaminated food. That's about 48 million people. That's quite a big impact, isn't it? 128,000 hospitalizations, over 3,000 deaths per year. So teaching people how to prevent food-related illnesses can be part of what we're doing. It says if you could just prevent 1% of foodborne cases, you could keep 500,000 people from becoming sick. So just a little bit of improvement can have a lot of effect, can't it? And there's a list of a variety of kinds of factors that can cause sickness and be passed in our food. And I won't take any time with that, but you might be interested in reading more about some of those. Here's an example of food poisoning. This was pretty recent, wasn't it? 2011. One of the largest meat producers in America recalled 36 million pounds of fresh and frozen ground turkey. That's a lot of turkey, isn't it? Gotten contaminated with antibiotic-resistant salmonella. And in our country, salmonella is very present in the poultry business, and we need to be very careful of that, and also with eggs. You need to consider every egg, or if you eat chicken or turkey, all of those things, you need to consider that they have salmonella on them. They must be kept separate in a separate place in the refrigerator. When you cook them, you need to make sure they're cooked thoroughly to kill those salmonella things, and clean all the surfaces and knives and things that was used in preparing them, because that's usually how it's passed along. Today, we give a lot of antibiotics to animals to promote faster growth and stop infections in the animals. And then the bacteria that are associated with those animals, they become resistant to it. And now we have a big problem in the United States that a lot of the bacteria are resistant to antibiotics. A lot of that comes from feeding it to animals. And the American Medical Association and others are making statements on that they're trying to eliminate that. But so far, we don't. And why don't we? Money. They can grow bigger, faster turkeys if they give them antibiotics. The chickens live a little longer and lay more eggs if you give them antibiotics. If they'd simply put them in a healthy living condition, they would do better, too, and you wouldn't have to do that, would you? Anyway, it's a big problem. Have you heard of E. coli contamination? I think we've all heard of that, and sometimes people dying from that. The 1993 was the first big one. They came out, and they tainted hamburgers in Jack in the Box, and 4 children died. Children are more susceptible to that simply because they're smaller. And, of course, many, many more were sickened. But we're still having those. And since then, there have been at least 10 known outbreaks of E. coli, and over 700 people made seriously ill. And it gets in and it affects the kidneys. It seems to harbor in the kidneys. And then if it gets too much of it there, it causes the blood to, what does it do? Anyway, it plugs up the kidneys. The kidneys quit functioning. The people have kidney failure. And if that's not corrected, the people can die from it. It's usually caused by fecal contamination of meat and poor sanitation and improper cooking. So if you ever do have people eating meat, it should be thoroughly cooked to kill that. And in all cases where it's been transmitted, it's usually because of poor cooking. But it doesn't have to be meat. Do you like cantaloupe? That was one of our latest outbreaks, wasn't it? And with Listeria bacteria. And people in 28 states were affected, and 29 adults died. and one miscarriage occurred that they know of. Probably more than that, but that's what they know of. And what was it caused by? Dirty equipment, poor sanitation, and unsafe food handling practices at a Colorado farm. Probably contaminated by nearby cattle farm and a truck that went there often. Listeria infection is common in cattle. So the truck went to the cattle and did things. They brought it back, and they used the same equipment for carrying the cantaloupe, and it was passed on, and then it went to the homes, and 29 people died. So we need to be careful. We need to wash even the foods that we can and wash our hands, cook things properly when we can, use good sanitation. Here's talking about don't cross-contaminate. So if you have eggs or meat or poultry in your refrigerator, they should be in a separate section and a separate cutting board and so on. And purify that area. Cook things well. Here's some recommendations. Whole meats cook at temperatures of at least 145 degrees internally or 160 plus degrees for ground meats, white ground meats. Usually the bacteria is on the outside, but when they grind it, the bacteria gets on the inside, so it must be cooked all the way through. And if it's not, that's when the people get the E. coli infections and so on. Poultry, cook at 165 plus degrees. Eggs, have you ever eaten eggs and when the yolk is still runny? It's not recommended. It should be cooked hot enough to cook it all the way through. So if you're eating the runny parts of the eggs yet, that's not safe. And when the food is left out, it should be kept to at least 140 degrees until it's served. And then afterwards, it should be chilled down to something cold. What is the thing on temperature and cold? Less than 40 degrees. I guess that says it over here. And refrigerate leftovers promptly. If you have food that is in large pans and things, it might stay warm for a long time on the inside, so they recommend shallow pans, cooling it quickly. And when serving, keep foods that are cold below 40 degrees. When it's above 140, the bacteria can't grow. It's too hot. When it's below 40, it's real cold, and they won't the toxins and things won't be formed. And so that's the idea. And be careful of keeping leftovers too long. And what are the highest risk foods? Raw milk is number one. Can be a lot of bacteria there. We used to have a lot of disease in America that's passed by raw milk. Now it's almost always pasteurized. Don't ever recommend raw milk. It's not safe. Raw eggs and foods can be a problem. Eggs cooked until runny. Raw fish. What's that called? Sushi. Not recommended. And usually they'll have signs up where they serve sushi warning people that this can be high risk, and especially for pregnant women and the unborn child is especially high risk. Sprouts and wild mushrooms, did you know that? To be careful, simply from contamination. Out-of-date food and other things that you can see there. So those are high risk. So the concept of cleanliness, using lots of water on the inside and the out, it's good, isn't it? Bathing, clothes, our homes, our neighborhood, even our nation, include an environment that is clean. Our rivers, our cities, our parks, our beaches, all of these things, when we keep them clean, it's a healthier environment. Make good sense? Cleanliness. We don't think of cleanliness as a health part of our health message sometimes, do we? But it is, and if we go to other parts of the world, we can recognize that more. Okay, there's some more references on food handling and things that you might like to get into. We'll try to have all those resources on all these areas as we get them finished up. Any questions on sanitation? All right. Might have been a topic you weren't expecting, but especially as we're doing work in other countries, very important. Okay, the next. Yes, uh-huh. Pardon? Oh, we're just going over there for fun, and my wife wants to see the terracotta soldiers in that, what is it called, Zion, and we're going to a whole bunch of places, so. I like China. It's an interesting place, an interesting culture. I've been there several times, and one time we went into Tibet, and we went got to go climbing on Mount Everest. I'm a mountain climber, so that was a big thrill. Yes, uh-huh. Okay, evaluating health information. I think we've got 15 minutes. We can do this one. Someone asked about this. How do we tell when we're looking at things? Is it good information or not to be trusted? So we're going to try to look at some ideas here. First thing we ask, who's providing the information? If they're giving information on drugs, it's probably the drug company, but you might also like to see what other people say about it. It's an alternative medicine company. There are no regulations on alternative medicine. They can say anything they want. Basically, it's the bottom line. And so most of their things that they put out are put out by someone who's trying to sell it, written by the ad agency. Probably has very little to do with real health information. Vitamins and food supplements, as much as basically the same thing, it's largely unregulated. And while they can't make, or supposed to not make claims about doing this or that other thing, they often do. And then when they get their hand slapped, they just take it off and just keep on selling it, claim something else next year. So anyway, it's a problem. Someone with something to sell, that's the basic thing, isn't it? So we need to be careful. And it might be good information, it might be true, but it might not. And in today's society, usually it isn't. If it's one of these things that they're trying to sell. If it's a web page, who's the sponsor? I always like to go to the about thing and find out who's sponsoring it. Is it a reliable organization or is it just somebody putting something on there that they have to sell? Is the information reviewed by experts? And if it is, what is their degree? Oftentimes I was reading a book once that was written by a fellow who had a PhD. And he's writing a book on nutrition, but his PhD was in sociology. Well, that doesn't mean he can't be a good researcher and find some good information, but he wasn't necessarily authority in that area, and it turned out the information was very poor. Are they healthcare professionals? Are they linked to a credible organization? Is their material show research references? You notice when I'm putting these studies up here and so on, I like to list. What medical journal do they come to? And if you want to look that up, you can. And when you use, if you want to use these materials for yourself, when you go into the speaker's notes, it'll have a full citation down there, and you can go and read about these things and read it for yourself. So that's important. Is the information largely testimonials? Are testimonials good, reliable sources of information? I had one lady when I was a pastor before I went back to Loma Linda. And I went to her home, and I was just a young intern, and the first thing she told me was she had bone cancer. I thought, oh, that's terrible. You know, I better go visit her a lot and give her encouragement, and I did. And then one of the days I was meeting her, and she said, her bone cancer is all cured. Wow, what did you do? And she said, well, she began to tell me then all about it. And I found out the way she was diagnosed with bone cancer, she sent a urine sample through the mail to somebody across the nation. And he diagnosed her with bone cancer. Well, you can't do that. But she didn't know that. And then what did he do? Well, he sold her a whole bunch of real expensive pills that she took for natural pills they were. She took those for several months, and then she sent another urine sample, and he declared her cured. And meanwhile, he took a whole lot of her money. And what is she doing now? She's selling the benefits of this wonderful doctor because he cured her from bone cancer. So she's telling everybody in town, you should talk to this doctor, and he's wonderful, and he cured me from cancer, and so on. A wonderful testimony. But how true is it? She didn't have enough education to realize that she was just been hoaxed for the whole thing. So we have to be careful of testimonials. Testimonials could be true, we don't know, but they're not reliable. So we like to have large studies like we've been talking about, where they have several thousand people, and they do randomized control studies, and they give part of their group a placebo, and part of the group they don't, or they separate it in some other way, and then several years later, did they get over cancer or didn't they? And if it shows a significant, statistically significant difference between the two groups, then we say, well, there's some evidence for that. Is it up to date? A lot of times we read books about health, and the information comes from a long time ago, and we didn't understand so much then, and now it may not be accurate. I hear some other warning signs. If it sounds too good to be true, probably isn't. Driving to work one day, there was a sign on weight loss. Maybe I put it up here. Anyway, it says, lose 30 pounds in 30 days. Call this phone number. Does that sound too good to be true? You know, if it really worked, we'd solve the obesity problem in America, wouldn't it? And we haven't solved that yet. But you give that person a certain amount of money and they'll tell you something. I'm not sure what. Makes outstanding claims. If the claims sound outlandish, then that's probably a clue, isn't it? Like the one over there on the right. Here's some outstanding claims. This is something I got in the mail here recently. It says, belly fat just melts away. Does that sound a little outlandish? Sounds impressive, doesn't it? You can burn up to 500 extra calories a day without any exercise. Oh, there you go. Don't even have to exercise now. It says, information that health professionals just plain don't tell you. And that's another one that you often hear. This is something that I'll tell you, but your doctor is hiding from you because he doesn't want you to know. Little clues, aren't they? And all of this, if you just buy my money-backed guaranteed book. So these are clues, aren't they? So what we want to have when we're teaching in our churches, in our community programs, is evidence-based information. We talked about clinical trials. That's the very best kind of information we can do. We learn about vitamin D from population studies, and then the next thing we want to do is we want to give it to people and see if it makes a difference. Like that one study we were looking at, they took vitamin D and the other group didn't, and they had fewer falls, showing that the muscle strength was better. Then there's another type of study called prospective studies. These are usually large in number. They're for longer periods of time, and much of what I have up here are prospective studies. And they hold constant for other possible causes. So when they're studying about the effects of exercise, they might also look at the person's weight and how old they are and their gender and whether they make a lot of money or don't, you know, socioeconomic factors. And sometimes there's a whole list of things that they want to hold constant for in their study and see, did exercise really make the difference, or was it because everybody's exercise was also rich and they had a different lifestyle, or they were very poor and had a different lifestyle, or whatever else it might be. So those are the kinds of things that they do in prospective studies, and those give us more confidence simply because of the large numbers. And we had some of them up here that was over 100,000 people. Meta-analysis. This is something else that's often done, where they'll take 10 or 15 studies and combine them so they get a lot more people. And some of the studies we've looked at here have been meta-analysis, where they take large numbers again and then combine them all together. And do they see a significant difference or not? If they don't, then they say there's no proof or evidence that it's beneficial for us. And then there's scientific reviews and summaries and by credible organizations such as NIH, as the National Institutes of Health. Their government, they have standards and so on that they look at closely. And the recommendations they make are usually made by groups of experts who study the evidence very carefully, usually the researchers that's involved. And if it's something that can be helpful, they recommend it. The NHLBI is the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute, very good organization for information on heart health. ADA, the one I'm thinking of here is the American Diabetes Association, and they have committees that make recommendations every year in Diabetes Care is the name of the medical journal, and they make about a 30 or 40 page printout on everything that's known about diabetes and the best possible way to take care of it and how to prevent it. And so every year in the January issue, I go there and I get it and I see what's new. And last year they had some new things, and you need to know those things. And then we use that information in teaching and educating people what are the best ways to take care of those problems. NCHS, the National Center for Health Statistics, the best organization for getting reliable health statistics in the United States. The Institute of Medicine, IOM, and they're an organization that is often contracted by the government to take a problem and study it and give us your best information on that. They do that, give those reports. And they're the ones that set the dietary guidelines, for example, and the dietary goals, how much vitamin D or vitamin C or whatever should we eat. And they study those things out carefully. And so when we teach information, usually we want to be in harmony with those organizations because that's the best evidence-based information we have for our country. Some other ways of telling reliable sources. Most health professionals, of course, would know a whole lot more about health than the person on the street. But sometimes we find that the person on the street seems to always be a health authority. And they know better than their doctor. Now, it doesn't mean that doctors don't make mistakes, but they have much more training, and we should trust them more. Recognized health organizations, and you can see the list down through there. We've mentioned just a lot of those now. When I'm looking for something on exercise, I go to the American College of Sports Medicine. They have the best guidelines available in America. And when you need good information on church health ministry, who would you go to? North American Division Health Ministries Department. And we've got good people in that department can help give you good guidance. So look for those reliable sources for good information. What I go to, I'm a health professional myself. I've been studying for years. I read probably 6 or 8 medical journals carefully every month, trying to keep up on the latest information on nutrition and fitness and disease prevention and so on. But sometimes I get stuck. And so who do I go to? I usually go to Loma Linda University and talk to the top people there, talk to the researchers doing the Adventist health study. I called him a while back on an issue, and we talked over some things. I like to go to Harvard University. They have a website called Nutrition Source. And unfortunately, right now, I say unfortunately because we don't have one as an Adventist church, and I'm lobbying for that. But right now, that's the best, most reliable source on nutrition, in my opinion, of anything that's on the web. And so if you're looking for good sources, that's what I'd recommend. It's by Harvard University. We talked about some of these others. Tufts University puts out a nutrition newsletter I like very well. And they seem to be very good on nutrition and prevention. And you can see other groups there. Mayo Clinic, John Hopkins Medical Group. These are all groups that have good sources of information. And then you can see the other national groups as well. I've also found American Family Practice has a website that has good, sound, basic information on healthy living. And it's usually quite concise. And also WebMD has very good health information. I go there every day, and they have health news that comes out. They read more journals than I'm able to because they have a staff of about 100 people. And if they've got some good news health things, I look at that, and I see what medical journal it's in, and I go to their website and read the abstracts. And if it's good material, I make it up, and we put it in our content. So those are the kinds of things that help us to find reliable sources. If you're not able to do all of that yourself, then you work with people who do that and try to use that kind of information. Peer-reviewed health journals. When research gets done, they like to publish it in a journal in that area. And as soon as you send it to the publishers, what do you suppose they do? They look it over with a careful eye. Was this good research? They actually send it to people who work in research in that area, have those specialists look over the article, look at what they did. Did they have good methodology? Did they come up with good results? And you know what they do? They reject most of the articles they get. And they tell them, you need to do better research, do this a little better, do that a little better, and then we might be able to publish it. So it's sometimes difficult. I did some things for the American JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and sent it in. And they sent it to all the reviewers, and they came back with 2 or 3 little things that I had overlooked, and I corrected those, and then they published them and used them. I wrote about 6 health programs for the AMA. It was on their website for several years. Haven't looked recently to see if it's still there. But anyway, that's the process they go through. And so you can see it there, all the different kinds of medical journals. They're very careful about what's there. This doesn't mean, again, it's always perfect. They don't make a mistake. But if they find more information later on, they will come back and correct that and let you know. And what I like to do is read the letters. You know, once a scientific journal has come out, and then there's other physicians and specialists around that read that article, and they may have a little different opinion. So they write it in their letter, and you can see different opinions. And it gives you, again, ways of evaluating information. So unreliable sources. Material from people with something to sell is usually the most common things. Some real interesting things. You know, you can wear magnets over parts of your body to help it be healthier. And I have an aunt who wears magnets on each side of her glasses, and it's supposed to help her vision. And I don't know how much she paid for it, but she believes in it. In the area of exercise, they've been selling oxygenated water. And they get people to pay extra money for this oxygenated water. Well, you take one deeper breath and you're going to get a whole lot more oxygen. You're going to get out a whole bottle of water. So anyway, they're susceptible. And for every kind of a funny thing, somebody's willing to pay money for it. And so it continues on, doesn't it? So we need to be careful of that. And talked about testimonials. Anonymous information. Get a lot of this on the Internet. We've talked about some of it because some of you have asked here today. One that says canola oil is toxic and will damage your health. Shouldn't even be used on your combine. Might rot it off. Rot the joints. All kinds of terrible things are said about it. Somebody was just mad at somebody and wrote all this up to see if they could hurt them. But so be careful of anonymous sources. And in teaching health principles, here's some principles to think about. If in doubt, be what? Skeptical. Ask a reliable source for their opinion. Avoid extreme views. In every topic, there's always extreme views, aren't they? And we want to have a balanced message. And if we don't, then people look at us as extremists, and they may be turned off, and they don't want anything to do with us. So that's very important, isn't it? There's a rule in medicine should apply as well in teaching health principles. It says, first, do no harm. Be sure it will do something good before teaching it. This is what is meant by evidence-based health information. So a lot of times people have recommendations and they may actually be harming the person. So we need to make sure that it won't do any harm. A good example of that is acupuncture for back pain. How many people have you heard that said, oh, wonderful thing, help my back pain to go away? And so they did a large study and they took several hundred people. And they gave half of the group acupuncture like it was supposed to be done. They had actually three groups, one that did that, one that had what they call sham acupuncture. And they went and they got treatment. They just stuck the needles randomly around through the body, not any place where they should be. People thought they were getting acupuncture. And then the third group got nothing. And then they followed this for several months to see what would happen. And those who got nothing, they still had just as much pain as ever. Those who went through the acupuncture had a 30% improvement in less pain and less back problems. And those who had the sham acupuncture had a 34% improvement. Well, what does this tell us? The mind has a powerful influence, doesn't it, on the body? And that's why sometimes you have to have these placebos and double-blind studies, because if we think it's going to help us, it often does. So we have to be careful of that. We're looking at PSA tests now for prostate cancer, and it looks like that it doesn't have much benefit in reducing number of deaths. So they're not recommending that so much anymore. Some of the things they're looking at mammograms, what age to start? And it's a little bit controversial right now, but the authorities say there's no benefit in starting before the age of 50. But because it's a political issue, they still recommend it by the age of 40. But the experts are saying you'll cause more breast cancers by starting at 40 than you will save, and you're better off to wait until you're 50 to start. So anyway, there's controversial issues. And what do you do when you have these controversial issues? Well, the best thing is to try to stay out of it if you can. Wait for more evidence. Or sometimes present both views and let people decide themselves. So anyway, some concepts there. Okay, any questions on reliability? Does that make good sense? We want our information to be accurate. We want people to build trust in us, have faith in us. And we don't want to do any harm. We want to help. We use those principles that help us.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.